y cuando te pegas fuerte más profundo es el beat, sí. Sigo bailando y escribiendo mis letras, sigo cantando con las puertas abiertas, atravesando por todas estas tierras y no hay que viajar tanto para encontrar la respuesta. Hey. No te preocupes si no te aprueban, cuando te critiquen tú solo di. Soy yo.
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Michael Van Cleek here, Vice President of the KBOO Board of Directors. KBOO's board is recruiting directors. KBOO's nominating committee is holding virtual information sessions from now through June. All KBOO community members are eligible for board election. Black, Indigenous, and people of color are especially encouraged to apply. Come join us. KBOO's Board of Directors guides the station's strategic plan and represents the interests and visions of our members. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/boardrecruiting. One word. Thank you for considering board service for KBOO Community Radio.
Show me your moves, baby, what it's...
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We are here in the Grand Lake Theater District of Oakland at a place called The Sanctuary. It is a nice shop that deals with health and well-being. They actually have an official name for it, and I can't pronounce it, but it's like apothecary. How do you say this?
Apothecary.
Apothecary. Yeah. There you go. So if you're ever in the area, you may want to check it out, but I'm here because I have a special guest all the way from New York, Kew Gardens, Queens, in case you're a New Yorker, you go, oh, wow, they're genuine. Her name is Ahime Aura. She has a couple of books. One book that I managed to get is dealing with what the ancestors said, and it's a book of affirmations. And I bought one, and then I was like, wait a second, you got another book. And this one is called Spirits Come From Water, An Introduction to Ancestral Veneration and Reclaiming African Spiritual Practices. And this caught my eye because, as we were saying yesterday, a lot of people have been searching and really trying to return to what they may consider indigenous roots in terms of their spirituality. And so we know here in the Americas, a lot of our indigenous brothers and sisters have long practiced and have long held on to a lot of their ancient ways, if you can use that word. And we know that a lot of our folks from the continent have also been searching. So let's start. How did you come about to write this particular book? What kind of moved you?
So Spirits Come From Water is essentially a call home. And it really was birthed from just my history of me. I was born in Ibadan, Nigeria, and I immigrated to the States when I was about 4.5 years old with my family. And this was something that was a really difficult experience for my mother, especially because I think there is that kind of stark difference between growing up in Nigeria, which was a very communal space, versus, you know, moving to the States, which is very hyper independent, you know, all man to themselves, those type of things that may not, you know, resonate more with that inclusive communal identity. So it actually really was incredibly difficult for my mother, and she struggled a lot with homesickness to the point that she had to get on antidepressants and things of that nature. But what healed my mother was the ability to recall her ancestors, her time in Nigeria. She would tell me stories of our ancestral lands, would tell me stories of water spirits and all of these things that were native to our traditions. And I thought these were all kind of like make-believe and fiction. But growing up, I realized these were kind of Easter eggs that my mom put for me in order for me to kind of find my way back home. If that makes sense.
So a couple of things come to mind. And I want to start off with assimilation, colonization. Mm. And I'm going to put those two words together intentionally. Part of the process with colonization is to kind of take away the savage practices that the Africans are doing. They're praying to water and praying to land and all this stuff, and get them to be good old Christians. And it gets complicated because many people say that Christianity also comes from the continent, but maybe the way that it's been used in colonization process is not the same way that it was initially practiced. But with that being said, being in Nigeria, which was one point colonized by the English, the British. Was there a battle with your mother to retain, you know, spiritual practices that were indigenous to you all versus this whole thing of missionaries and everybody trying to, you know, bring you into the 21st century?
Yeah, I think there was that intense religious colonialism and religious imperialism that was happening in Nigeria. The missionaries would actually go through the villages, kind of manipulating children to throw away that their ancestral altars and their shrines for money. So there was that kind of influence of, you know, Christianity was the way. And even just how my mother and my father, they went to boarding schools, and those boarding schools kind of was really popular during like colonial time Nigeria, and these were
we're not talking about a century ago. No, we're talking about recent years.
Yes, we're talking about literally like around 1960s. That's so not too long at all. And these missionaries would use these boarding homes to essentially drive in the Christian thought and drive an almost antagonistic way of looking at your ancestral traditions. So my mother, she grew up like with an understanding of her indigenous spirituality, but she was also a practicing Christian. So these two things aren't like, they can coexist at the same time. I think there's a stark contrast. People think you have to be one or the other. But my mother, she has really showed me that two things can kind of live within the same body. She's the one that she goes to church every Sundays. She's very consistent with her Bible practice, but she can also name our ancestors past six generations. She's the one that told me everything about who I am today, you know? So I think there was a battle, an internal battle that she had to make for herself when we immigrated, because that's a lot of othering, you know, for being Black, African immigrant, not having much money and practicing an African spiritual practice. You kind of have to pick a struggle in some kind of way. So my mother was like, you know what, let's just keep going to church. Let's just keep, because that was also a space for community as well. So let's just keep doing that. And for her, it wasn't more about just dogma, but it was about trying to find a way for us to survive in America.
You talked throughout your book, and definitely in the very beginning, about people constantly searching and searching for connection, searching for spirit. Can you elaborate on that a little?
I think especially with the pandemic that happened, people had a space to really be still and to really think about themselves. The pandemic was probably the most recent wave of spiritual renaissance that I've noticed. But this has always been something more. People are searching for spirituality that allows for them to be whole. You know, I think with Christianity and just Catholics, being Catholic and et cetera, those concepts of being like being born a sinner or being born unworthy, being born having to like forgive yourself. But with African spirituality, it really allows for me to be my most authentic self. I'm the most at peace practicing ancestral practices, connecting with my ancestors, seeing more awareness through the environment. And I think people are searching for that kind of pull, you know.
If you're just tuning in, that's the voice of author Ehime Ora. She has a book out called Spirits Come From Water, An Introduction to Ancestral Veneration and Reclaiming African Spiritual Practices. There's an old saying that the God that the slave owner was praying to was not the same God the enslaved African was praying to. Mm. And we talk even to this day that there's a huge difference when you go to a proverbial white Christian church and a black church. Mm. And my experience has been that in many ways, whether it was intentional or not, mm-hmm. there are things that occur in the black church mm-hmm. that are very similar mm-hmm. to what I'm reading in your book mm-hmm. in terms of some aspects of African, mm-hmm. you know, spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. There's this thing of spirit coming into the room, mm-hmm. Talking in tongues. Mm-hmm. There's a whole thing about communal, mm-hmm. you know, like you got to connect mm-hmm. and you don't want to leave until that connection is there. Mm. The fact that people look at this as a liberatory mm-hmm. type of endeavor yeah. Is very different than one where you often hear about punitive, you know, punitive type of actions for something that you may or may not have done. And some have said that these are holdovers, this type of way of worshiping mm-hmm. that we often see in the black church is a holdover from, you know, from different parts of Africa where mm-hmm. we have come from. Yeah. So one, in your practice and understanding, do you see a similarity and a parallel? Mm-hmm. And that's one question. The second one is, with the missionaries in Nigeria, the type of Christianity that, say, your mom practiced, mm-hmm. you know, in the continent, did it veer away and find its own unique space the way that I think mm-hmm. black Christianity here in the States has? Mm.
Absolutely. I think we become the gods that we pray to. And I absolutely agree that there is a difference and a distinction between the Christian in white churches and like how it feels in black churches. And I can remember my first experience being in a black church when we immigrated and how it was almost an out of body experience that I felt.
Did you feel at home when you
were? I felt at home. I did. And it was something that I also see in Nigerian churches as well. They bring in spirit in a way with like the holy oils, the holy waters, the prayers. And utilizing this Christianity as a force of spiritual revolution, if that makes sense. That's why there's a difference, in my opinion, of being a religious person and being a spiritual person. I feel like you can be Christian and be more on the religious dogmatic side and be Christian and be more of the spiritual side. And the black churches also kind of take some pieces of hoodoo culture as well. Hoodoo and conjure were flattened to kind of preserve native traditions that were coming from the Congo, coming from the Igbo, Nigeria as well, flattened and preserved within the black church. So yes, there are certain types of those spiritual African elements within them.
How would you identify mm-hmm. a type of practice, a type of gesture, a type of way in which people evoke, what would you identify and say, yeah, that's African, that's holdover, that's us right there, if you see somebody practicing their spirituality, what makes it African?
What makes it African is the root that it gives. And what makes it African, I think, even in these concepts of like call and response, in our relationship to dance, in our relationship to music, there are certain rhythms and certain vibrations that we elicit, and it goes back to the preservation. We are archivists, and we archive our ancestral practices with the full body, the music, the chanting, the songs, and it creates these rhythmic of remembering. And I feel like that's what makes it more African. It's more of a holistic sense.
There was a point in many places where having the music, mm-hmm. having the chanting has mm-hmm. been called uncivilized and not even Christian, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Was that something that missionaries were pushing on the African and you yeah. all just kept it anyway?
Yes, there was, you know, I think with missionaries and just with like Western involvement, there's a lot of just being still and listening to music. Like you can look at like classical music, for example, there's a lot of just being present and witnessing it. There's not a lot of engagement through it. There's not a lot of physical sensation, and I could be wrong, but what I see within West African and just African in general on the continent is we believe in bringing you into the experience.
Yeah, it's a communal thing.
Mm-hmm. We don't believe in that gaze, that voyeurism, you know?
So how did that reconcile itself with missionaries saying, this is how you do it, what y'all are doing is the devil's work?
I see that it's happened the same thing of just like what happened with Black Americans utilizing hoodoo and conjure in Nigeria. There is the same thing happening within the mega churches. They are saying certain things about this Christianity, using the Bible in ways that are very spiritual and very African indigenous spiritual in ways. But if you tell them that, they're like, that's not really what I'm doing. But you're saying the same prayers, you're doing the same oils, you're going days with just chanting and chanting and chanting. Like, that is a type of African spiritual like velocity that they're doing.
Yeah, Mary Baraka called them Africanisms, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
At least as it pertains for folks over here.
Right.
The Bible is a very interesting construct.
Yeah.
It's been used to enslave folks and justify enslavement, which is very interesting because at least here in America, black folks, enslaved black folks weren't allowed to read.
Yeah.
Is there a book that somebody who is practicing some of the traditional spiritual practices on the continent, do you have a book that you use? Because you talk about prayer and you have names and of gods and all that, but is there a book that you go to?
So I don't go to books. I think books are a great way for archiving wisdom, but a lot of like African traditional spiritual information is learned through our elders. And it's kind of passed down through that oral
tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. But there are certain books that has opened me up. And one of them is Of Water and the Spirit by Maladoma Patrice Somme. And he was a Burkina Faso shaman that also went to the West and brought more of his African traditional practices and understanding. And he has written excellent books on just returning back to Africa, returning back to spirituality. I reference him in my own book, Spirits Cut from Water, and in his my acknowledgments in the back. So he's definitely a huge figure.
But there's no spiritual book.
I feel like there isn't, because it's just so vast, you know? So much information that can't be compiled, just like how the Bible has a compilation. Within what I practice is Ifa and the Orisha practice, and we believe in these things called the Odu. And the Odu are kind of like wombs or books of life, books of knowledge, and there's 256 of them. So that's a lot. And within each one, there's like 10,000 verses that extends, and it has all of these.
Wait, so these are books?
These aren't actual books, okay. But they're like concepts, if that makes sense.
Right.
So we were referenced like, in the first Odu, which is Ejiogbe, it has this, 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 and this. So it has 256, so it's kind of running on like a mathematical algorithmic system.
Now, you mm-hmm. live in New York.
Yeah.
And so, and I've never been a member, right? But the fact that you're talking about referencing a type of, you know, books and lessons, so to speak. Yeah. I'm going to use that word, right? You know, you have a spinoff of the Nation of Islam with the Five Percenters, right. Nations of Gods and Earth, and they talk about having these lessons and what's the science and all that. And as I was reading your book, certain things from, you know, again, I'm saying it from the outside, so is anybody with the Nation of the Gods and Earth, don't be like, you got it wrong, but I see a lot of, like, focused on you literally being the God, you having this connection, you having to come to one, you having to draw up on these lessons, as you point about. Being in New York, did you see any similarities to the way that some of the brothers, sisters would be like, man, I'm a member of the Nation of the Gods and Earth, this is how we see it, or are those two very different things? Because in some ways, it seems very African, even if they don't put that title on it. It seems like, yeah, that's a throw. That's still connecting.
I think with all of those, it's like that pan-African perspective. I think people are just really trying to be as close and as connected to their roots. So there is those similarities. And also, I think a huge similarity is that push for history. I think you can't really understand spirituality without understanding your history and understanding your culture. So I think both of these groups kind of like manifest those kinds of similar backgrounds.
That's the voice of Ehime Ora. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about her book, Spirits Come From Water, An Introduction to Ancestral Veneration and Reclaiming African Spiritual Practices. You talk about the creator, and every society has a creation story. They have a creator. It seems very similar. In the beginning, there was nothing, and something was spoken, and you know, that's the Christian way, right? But there's very similar things that everybody has. Talk about the one that you're talking about here, and the creator, and the dance that, you know, folks do with the creator, because in your case, you talk about being reborn every day.
Yes, being reborn every day. So that's actually such a beautiful concept. Like the whole going back to you being your own God, that's really within the Ifa and Orisha system. We have a huge concept called the Ori, which means literally the head in Yoruba. So the Ori is referring to your literal head, but also referring to the divine concept of your higher self, of your higher destiny. So that's kind of also referring to just like how the creator bestowed their ashe into our heads, into our destinies, allowing ourselves to be our own gods on earth. So that little intuition, those little being poles and connections that we have, those are the ones that like is referencing our Ori, our higher self concept.
Now somebody would say, you can't be your own god. That is so, that is so like arrogant. There's God. And then you all, you know, we're all supposed to pray to God. You even talk about that. But being your own God, that's a slippery slope, somebody might say. You know, I'm going to go get me a 40 ounce and start pimping, and I'm my own God, you know?
I would say there is one God, right, which is Olodumare in our particular tradition. But we also believe that everything that we see was created by God, created by the Creator. So we are the living embodiments of the Creator. And actually living like that, leaning into it, allows for our life to be more open and more expansive and to be able to see the Creator in everything. And that can also help you treat the world better, treat nature better, treat the oceans better, even treat each other better when you recognize your own inner divinities. So that doesn't mean to go into the arrogance and the egoic side of it, right? But into a more of an all-encompassing, if that makes sense.
They say the difference between the way indigenous folks, whether you're from the continent or here, see the world is that we are one with the world. Everything is sacred. The water is sacred. The air is sacred. The animals are sacred. And they have a certain reverence that we have. And then it's the other way, the Western construct of dominion. I'm here to rule over. Very, very different philosophies that have, you know, for hundreds of years have run smack dab against each other. Talk a little bit about the dance of being at one. And is there any sort of deviation where people have said, no, I rule over, you know?
Yeah, I think with Ifa and Orisha, there is also this concept of two destinies are not the same. So there's no those overarching commandments or overarching dogmic figures of like how to be an Ifa and Orisha practitioner. The only overarching thing that we have is this concept called Iwapele, which is good character. being someone of good character, of integrity, of compassion, of empathy, of kindness. Those are the testimonies, the testaments of character that the Creator is kind of looking for us as practitioners. So because of that, there isn't, or at least a lot of us try not to be like pedestal preachers, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And we also, there hasn't been much colonization or imperialism, even at all, when it comes to Ifa and Orisha. There has, to be honest, can be certain types of exploitation or certain types of manipulation, because people are so searching for their roots and their culture, and people may take advantage of that. But just like in Christianity, and just like in Islam, and just like in Judaism, there are bad eggs, and that does not make an entirety of the culture.
Nigeria also has a Muslim population.
It does.
Is that something that is indigenous in terms of like, well, you do Ife, and you do that, and I do this, or was it something that was imposed on folks?
It was due to the Arab slave trade and also the influence of just Islam into Nigeria. That has been an influence within Nigeria, just as Christianity has been as well. However, I also think that just because they are influenced, they don't need to leave. Does that make sense? They don't need to be disintegrated, but there has to be more acceptance for traditional practitioners in Nigeria, because we are actually facing a lot of discrimination and a lot of oppression in our own native origin. Does that make sense? So it's even like something that is even just blows my mind, between like the lack of acknowledgement and even what I say. We have like a UNESCO heritage site within Osun Oshogbo State called the Oshun River for the Orisha Oshun. In my opinion, if this was not a UNESCO heritage site, literally, you know, protected by the world, I don't believe Nigeria would have kept the river, in my opinion, because of the way that they treat traditional spirituality. I believe that river would have been already polluted, and they would have already teared it down, in my opinion.
You know, the way capitalism in all its exploits had manifested itself, one might even say that's a religion.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
it becomes an entity, you know, with all that thing that you force into, it becomes its own life force, you know, and that can create such incredible destruction in our lives.
Real talk. With that being said, do capitalism have a way of infusing itself into everything, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be Christian, but it can be very capitalistic in its thing. Mm-hmm. You know, my personal opinion, I've been to churches where, you know, like, if you don't got no money, it means that you didn't really pray. Mm. And if you want to get that blessing, you better give the preacher, you know, maybe more than 10% of your tithings, but how about 70%, you know, we literally have seen that, right? Yeah. We've also seen folks will take aspects of things that you wrote about in this book and all of a sudden pass themselves off as, you know, an Oshari, you know, priestess, and you can join my movement for $1,000. We've seen that, right?
Yeah.
So how do we start to recognize the seeds of capitalism and exploitation that show up in these practices and distinguish them from the very genuine, and I think from reading the book, the very wholesome way in which people want to practice and find a spiritual path and really, you know, find themselves.
Absolutely. I think the concept of like wealth, money, and even enterprise and commerce, those are things that are inherently African to start out with. Within Ifa, we believe in this Orisha called Orisha Aje, and this is the Orisha that sees over wealth in the marketplace and commerce. And she is also the child of Oloku, which is the child, which is the Orisha of the ocean, of the waters. So money is like water, and money should flow like water. But also like water, money should be pure, because we all know how water gets dirty, and that's just not, it doesn't nourish you on anything, and it gets all these little dust and bites and all that stuff. So money inherently needs to be pure in order to have longevity to it.
How do you purify it?
How do you purify it? By not choosing profit over human beings. That's really what it is. It's the capitalism. It's not about asking for an exchange of currency, because within Ifa, a priest deserves to be paid for their work, but it doesn't mean that I have to exploit you for your money.
Right.
It doesn't mean that I have to, you know, when you say, I don't really have much, can you help? It doesn't mean I turn you away. We actually don't believe in turning anyone away who comes for help and assistance, no matter how much they have, you know? So I think it goes back to the whole for-profit that people kind of use rather than being a human being doing something for the greater humanity.
You say in your book, you know, this is not a book just to read all in one sitting. Right? You intersperse it with poems and reflections, things of that nature. If I pick up the book, give me two or three chapters that you really want us to maybe sit back, reflect on, and dig deep in. You know, and for you, what was really satisfying?
Chapter one, homesickness. I really love this chapter because this chapter, I kind of welcome you more into my family, into what it means to be displaced and how everyone, even on the continent, is struggling with that sense of homelessness and homesickness. So that's a really good introductory chapter. I also recommend the second chapter, which is The Creator's Love Fills the Head, which we talk about the Ori concept. We break down the creation story within Ifa. We talk more about being our own God on earth and how our Ori can open us up to our destiny and our alignment. And I also recommend the grief and healing chapter as well. That chapter is really good because a lot of us are going through suffering, pain, you know, heartache, traumas, and we can utilize our ancestral veneration in our African spirituality, not just to make money or become famous, but to elevate our lives, to heal. That's what it's all about anyway.
You have another book, Ancestors Said, so it's about affirmations. Are those affirmations, you know, which you lay out that can be read each day, are those things that you're pulling over from the traditions?
Yeah, those are fun things actually personally for myself and my ancestral lineage, but they're also philosophies and concepts from the Ifa tradition within them as well.
You know, also, there's a thing now where a lot of Black folks are like, I'm talking to the ancestors, right?
Yeah.
And you hear that a lot. Now, I don't know, you know, first of all, this is part of that. Right,
yeah.
Talking to the ancestors, so that's an Africanism.
Yeah.
But do I have to do a little bit more than others say, well, I'm talking to the ancestors? There seems to be some things we need to really do to talk to the ancestors.
Yeah.
Break that down for us.
You can set up an ancestral altar space. An ancestral altar doesn't have to be a big whole thing. It could be something with basic elements that you have in your house.
I see a lot of people doing altars now.
Yeah. Get you like a little space, a little tabletop, a shelf, whatever you feel comfortable. Have like a little nice cloth over it. It could be white in color. It could be an African fabric, whatever you prefer. Get a glass of water, some candles. Get, you know, some photos of your family members. Put some fruits on there and boom, you made yourself an ancestral
altar. That's a universal thing.
Yeah.
A lot of different people kind of practice it.
Absolutely.
So just set up the altar? Do I need to pray to them? You know, some people say you only pray to God. You don't be praying to the ancestors, but pray to the ancestors.
Yeah, I think prayer is literally just talking with intention. So you are praying, talking with intention to your ancestors. And it doesn't have to be in the most like Shakespearean formal way. It can be just as you and I are talking right now. You can talk to your people and give them gratitude for your life and ask for whatever you need. And you can do this. I recommend doing this every morning before you start your day, if you could.
So now there's a big elephant in the room. So let's address it. There are people listening and saying, I hear this is nice, this is cute, but our people are being oppressed, whether they're in Nigeria, whether they're in Oakland, whether they're in New York, where you live, all over the planet, we're going through it. We're watching the rise of fascism as we are sitting here right now.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that are prayed. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people that are practicing.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't see some sort of deliverance from that. One, is it wrong to expect a deliverance? Two, somebody told me a long time ago there's a concept that says, well, your God may be more powerful than my God, and that's just a thing that people have learned to accept. Or, which you also talk about in the book, you know, there are these other ways in which we measure success and find solace. So how do you break that down when somebody goes, I ain't praying to no mystery God. Look at our people.
Yeah, I think deliverance is something that I believe will happen to Black people because it must. It has to realign the earth, in my opinion. And this is just because of just a few things. The first being like with the Christian God, like Yahweh originally being like a desert storm God. So his concept of conquest is his biggest offering. So why imperialism was a satisfying offering for him, colonialism was a satisfying offering for him, all the bloodshed of Black people was a satisfying offering for him to expand more of his persona of an energy of Yahweh, this Christian God. But I also believe
that's a bad thing though, right?
It is a bad thing.
Yeah.
It's not a good thing. And that is also why our spirituality is not just to heal, but it's to create and usher the revolution. Because it happened in Haiti with the Haitian voodoo. That was literally instrumental in overthrowing the French. Without that, these war loas that were orchestrating with the people, these things would have created more issues or struggles in the overthrowing of the French government or the French colonization. And this is kind of even the same thing with Obia, with the Queen Nanny of the Maroons. So you see these things of like utilizing even hoodoo and conjure to sustain people who were enslaved, to protect them. There were these concepts that we were doing already, that we have been doing to overcome oppression. You know, so I don't think it's more about like, see what they're not doing. I think it's more about things take time. You know, we were enslaved for centuries. We are still being oppressed, and things are being chipped away and going back to the baseline in order to be rebuilt stronger. So the breakdown is what we're experiencing. It's going to be really bad before it gets really good. You know, and that's just how things have to balance itself energetically.
I'm glad you mentioned in the book you did talk about Haiti, and you also mentioned a lot of other freedom fighters. One of the things I find challenging is when there's this oversimplification. They gave us the Bible and then we went into slavery. And I'm like, well, most of the freedom fighters that was really about that life, the Nat Turner, they were pretty devout, the David Walkers.
Yes.
And when you look at their history, in fact, they became emboldened because they suddenly didn't fear death. They had a whole other spiritual thing that they was riding. So from Denmark Vesey, you mentioned Harriet Tubman and others. These are folks that, you know, if we're talking about, well, they gave them the Bible and they somehow... You know, Harriet Tubman took that Bible and freed a bunch of people. You know, Nat Turner was waiting on the signs from God before he decided, like, okay, I got my sign. Let's go about
solar
it.
Eclipse. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we deal with that? You know, this whole concept of liberation and understanding that taking on a religion, if you may, or a spiritual understanding doesn't necessarily mean you're somehow weakened and somehow not about the business of freeing yourself and freeing your people. It, to me, it's like, nah, I got that protection, so let's go. You know, 10 toes down, I'm not afraid to die.
Absolutely.
I really ain't. I got that spirit. I'm filled with it. And I've seen that aspect of it, which becomes very scary for folks. Like, these folks is ginned up. What's going on? It's like, the Lord is with me, and I'm going to free myself.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what I said about there are so many ways these two things can live in the same body. This understanding of ancestral connection, of freedom, and Christianity. So it's not about being anti-Christianity. It's more so being anti-dogma that teaches you to believe that your ancestral practices are evil, that teaches you to believe that your ancestors are demonic. Those are the things that you want to let go, because opening yourself up to that is what creates more strong, sustainable freedom, you know?
As we close out, any last things you want to leave people with? And do I have to do something to connect with the spirit, because that's the other thing. People go, you know, you need to smoke this, drink this, you know, do 10 Hail Marys, and then you can connect. Or is this something that is really a personal spiritual journey for each person?
It's something personal for each person. I think once you just open yourself up to saying, "This, I decide to be connected to my ancestors," you will see your life just trying to organize its way and doing that. And maybe you kind of find yourself more in an African spiritual practice like Ifa or Orisha, or maybe like a Khan in Ghana. And those have more like protocols and elders and things of that nature. But everyone can be more connected to spirit. Everyone can open themselves up. It's about being more willing and open-hearted, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I've said this with my last question. I have one more. Nigeria is a huge place.
Yes.
So you have tons of different languages, mm-hmm. people, and mm-hmm. all that. Outside of Nigeria, mm-hmm. and into the other continents, do you find a common denominator in terms of spiritual practice, or are they night and day differences depending on where you go?
There is a common practice is ancestral veneration.
Okay.
Ancestral veneration is the baseline and the foundation that connects all of us in the African, on the continent, and in diaspora, the homage to those of generations forward and backwards. And other things that I noticed that are pretty similar is this pull to full body experience, like that music, the chanting, the drumming. That is something that is there because even spirits need vehicles, and art can act as that vehicle for spirit to enter.
Mm. So really uplift our art, mm-hmm. get on that vibration.
Absolutely.
We appreciate you. How do we get a hold of you, Hemi?
You can follow me on my platforms on Instagram. I'm on X. I'm on the TikTok. I'm on my email newsletter. And you can find me on my website, ahimeora.com. I teach on my Patreon for those who are interested in spiritual understandings of Ifa and Orisha and ancestral reminders. And I also have a Substack in which I write essays regarding Africa culture, spirituality, and art.
Spell your name so everybody knows.
Ahimeora, E-H-I-M-E. Space O-R-A. Thank you so much.
There you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
All began in Africa. offerings placed where the spirits reside. Candles burn bright as the elders confide. Not lost, not broken, just finding our way back to our roots where the orishas stay.
It all began in Africa.
Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Black folk. Black look like a revolution. Look like a family reunion in the park. Black look like it's a different world. Sound like a crawfish ball in New Orleans. Black folk joke around like Martin and got paintings from JJ in the living room. It sounds strong. Look like sacrifice. It'd be flowers blooming in the summertime. Black sound like old songs. Smell like good food. And it tastes like heart disease, but it feel like maize at Jazz Fest. Black sound like something that hurt, like a hard test. Black sound like skin, like something dark. It look like hair, yeah, black sound like rough hair and good hair. Look like history, sound spiritual. Black sound like years, like working, like night. Black sound like money, look like Walmart. Like corner stores, like cash register singing. Black sound like 400 years. Smell like Oprah. Impactful like Martin. Look like Cicely Tyson. Sing like Nina. Got a like Serena. Feel like broken homes in Section 8. Black smell like crack and collard greens. Sounds motivational. Feels like church. Look like big Sunday hats and ribbons.
Smile like your mama. Beautiful child, oh, you're the one. Fly like your daddy, make me so happy. Beautiful child, oh, you're the one.
Sound like Dick Platt swinging and sneaky uncles. Look like Tyler Perry making money. Sound like hating, feel frustrated, don't it? Like they don't get it. Like they won't ever get it, huh? Like, push your personal feelings of racial injustice so far underneath the carpet that you trip over your own family history. But I love me some black folk. I love the hair grease and the rental fees, the front row seats, the police, the projects, the mustard greens, being late, social security checks, government assistance, bougie black looking good, bags of hair, fake press on nails, rat tail comb, stunting gold chain, gold teeth, black men and big feet. I love me some black folk. For they are the people that were made from the darkest parts of the sky.
Smile like your mama, eyes like the sun. Beautiful child, oh, you're the one. Fly like your daddy, make me so happy. Beautiful child, oh, you're the one. I'm in a place when I see your face. Must be nostalgia.
for child, I am the one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Black don't crack, I love your skin. I don't see that from other kin. Yesterday and any day, I see me and my doing different things, pushing boundaries. Waves come, AIDS comes, overseas.
What you think I came to L.A. for?
Everybody from the 504, what you think I came to L.A. for? Everybody from the 504, what you think I came to L.A. for? Everybody from the 504, what you think I came to L.A. for?
The Betrayal of Gaza, again. It was, by any measure, a stunning moment. An American president essentially offering to gentrify the Gaza Strip, suggesting that they, should they resist, be forced to leave their historical homeland by the armed forces of the United States of America. They're living in hell, proclaimed Trump, as he sat a few feet away from the man who bombed it to hell and ordered that destruction. That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Trump said these coastal lands could be made as lovely as the Riviera. It'll be beautiful, he said. Netanyahu beamed at every word. And while Trump saw it as a grand real estate deal, Netanyahu saw it as the ultimate Zionist dream. Palestinians saw it as the ultimate nightmare. For they had lived for the better part of a century with political betrayals. Since Israel's founding in 1948. For over 70 years, they have lived under an occupation that the United Nations has called illegal, but it has never done anything about it. Now, the U.S. is touting an illegal removal of millions of Palestinians from their own homeland. Is this the gentrification of Gaza? Probably not. But who can really say? Who indeed? We can only hope that Palestinians have the last word. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
sensitive. Life is just like a settlement, waiting for you to cash on it. Life is just like a bike, it don't move unless you pedal. And less about who is better and more about who blessing them. Softer than gelatin, peanuts to elephants. You dumb as a boss of Ross if you think it's irrelevant. My granny been popping Zanny since CBS met the nanny. My mammy Danny, she tripper than Annie. And I'm not talking to family, but I've been dreaming of fishing since I've been watching the Grammys. And I'm here to stay like the in your panties. I need some standing ovation since y'all can't seem to understand me. I might look fly in the matrix. I hope I'm sticking my landing. No need to bring fall back in August, September. You should just fall back in. Wait. Who wants to clear the fog and all the smog in your mirrors? Well, you could just fall.
Hard nine. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in. Real talk, don't stop. Ian Man at it again. Sam Man, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else should just imitate the simulation. Step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Woo.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost or the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel gray beats. Say please, maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I made with a please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. You go, but it ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Bird Note. An uncut field of waist-high grass might not seem like a valuable habitat at first. It doesn't have tall, mature trees like a forest. It doesn't have a pond full of fish and frogs. So, to a bird, what's so great about a field of grass? Many birds have adapted to nest in grassland habitats and nowhere else. In North America, birds such as the bobolink seek out grasslands to raise their young, deftly hiding their nests within the dense vegetation. The wildflowers and grasses host countless insects that feed the birds and their hungry chicks. And there's more to a grassland than meets the eye. While a forest stores carbon within wood, grassland plants have roots that reach several yards into the soil and deposit carbon within it. That can help protect birds around the world from climate change. Very few grasslands and savannas have been protected compared to the area that's been lost, making them the most at-risk ecosystem on the planet. That means every acre of grassland remaining is even more precious to birds, to plants, and to people. To learn how you can support grassland habitats, visit birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
This is Bird Note. Every spring, one of the most musical and complex bird songs on the continent rings forth from the sagebrush of the Columbia Basin in Washington State. The Brewer's Sparrow, a migratory songbird that winters mostly in western Mexico, returns in April to the sage. Sagebrush habitat, often called shrub steppe, is a common landscape of the interior West. However, each year, more and more of it is being cleared for irrigated crops and development. The diminutive Brewer's Sparrow shares its nesting habitat with other fancy singers, like the long-winded Sage Thrasher and the melodic Vesper Sparrow. All three of these birds are sandy brown in color, blending so seamlessly with their surroundings that only a sharp eye can pick them out. Yet even among this accomplished company, the Brewer's song stands apart. While most birds offer a melody, the Brewer's Sparrow seems to perform an entire aria. Find all our episodes and a lot more information about birds at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.